If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Truth and Movie Special Scary Edition. As we look at ghost stories, A Quiet Place, definition of a silent but deadly release, death-defying drama in Wonderstruck, and Thoroughbreds, best thing since sliced bread. All that plus Don't Look Now in our film club. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Today's Little White Liars are Hannah Woodhead.
Hi.
Hi, Hannah. You don't sound sure about that.
I was like, Little White Lies? Little White Liars? Is that what you said?
It was an exciting nomenclature which was invented by one of our listeners.
Ah.
David Jenkins is also very much in the house.
Hi, hi.
Excellent. That sound is David because?
It's our 50th edition of the podcast.
And still sounds as fresh as the day we started.
Indeed. We're not listless and sour and bitter at all.
Excellent.
By this point.
And why would we be with so many terrific films? We've got a bumper crop, actually, and not much time in the studio between you and me, listeners. So we're going to have to fly through these a little bit. Let's start with one that I think is going to require a little bit of comment, and it's Ghost Stories. Arch-skeptic Professor Philip Goodman, played by writer and director Andy Nyman, stumbles across a long-lost file containing details of three cases of inexplicable hauntings and embarks on a terror-filled quest to uncover the truth.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Professor Philip Goodman. I'm here today to share three apparently supernatural incidents with you, all of which seem deeply troubling.
Hello? Anyone there?
The spirit. The unquiet spirit.
The brain sees what it wants to see. My job is to try and untangle the truth from the fiction. My job is to explain the unexplainable.
How did you feel about this, Hannah?
Yeah, I kind of went into it not knowing anything about it. And it's a very strange film. I think it's going to be one thing and then it's another thing. And I don't think it's any of the things particularly well. It was sort of an interesting premise. I think it has some really good performance. Paul Whitehouse is fantastic in it. Yeah. And he was like the main highlight. Could have done with more of him. And Alex Lawther, if anyone is a fan of End of the F***ing World on Netflix, he does a little part in this and he's very good as well.
Yeah, although he's given a bit of a hospital pass by Andy Nyman, the writer and director, because he very much has to carry the middle segment with his manic, freaked out teenager. And I think after a bit, with the camera just resting solely on him being manic and all his various tics and nervousisms, it does get a bit wearing. But I completely agree with what you're saying. It's very overstretched, this film. There has been some suggestions that it was filmed over a weekend, and I don't think they finished it, maybe. I know that the ending does resolve a lot of the kind of the questions that I had midway through, but still.
See, I had more questions than answers from the ending. I was like, I didn't really understand why they chose to end it the way they did. I could see they kind of wanted to tie everything together very neatly and have that whole sort of, you know, usual suspects big reveal, but it didn't really work for me. I felt it was kind of insincere and, just a bit laboured and a bit forced.
It could have been a and this won't disagree with that, a Tales of the Unexpected from back in the day, David, yeah. Do you think?
No, absolutely. I think one of the things that... I mean, the film has definitely got its fans. Mm-hmm. I think maybe specifically in the kind of horror community. That's horror fans rather than, like, horrific beings. I think it really is kind of very kind of reference-filled, and it kind of harks back to all these classic-era triptych films and little kind of what would you call them?
Portmanteau
films, like Dead of Night, where you get three little tall tales, or Tales from the Crypt, even.
It reminded me of Creepshow, which I was a big fan of.
No, no, absolutely. There's almost a kind of Dickensian vibe to them, where you're sort of seeing these three little
like
stories
Penny
within stories. And I think it's sort of trying to offer up a kind of modern-day version of one of them, and you get this character played by the co-director, Andy Nyman, made alongside Jeremy Dyson. And he is meeting with these three people and visualising the situations that they were in. And you get these sort of three little kind of very different spook stories. And I think you're watching them and you're as you guys have said, you're kind of constantly questioning, how are these all going to come together? What's the kind of connecting tissue? And when you eventually find out what that connecting tissue is, it is a little bit kind of...
You were underwhelmed.
Yeah, it didn't...
Were you scared? Is it a scary movie?
The segment involving Paul Whitehouse, I thought was really well done, especially because you're kind of conditioned into thinking, oh, it's Paul Whitehouse, he's going to be funny.
Also because the dialogue, and this is one thing I thought was really refreshing about this film, it's very matter-of-fact, it's very uncliched. Lines like when he's introducing to the investigator, he's beginning his anecdote, he's beginning his recollections with a line, it was 3:45 in the morning, that's a time of night.
Yes.
But unfortunately, whilst the dialogue is unconventional, it is fresh, the scares were film 101.
It was jump scares all the way. Mm. And
Paul Whitehouse plays like a caretaker of a haunted, disused mental asylum. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really, could you? And it's him hearing clanging noises in the middle distance, and his radio goes all funny, and he's got to go out and check. And it's done pretty well.
And but he is good.
I think you're watching the film and you're watching the talent involved and the kind of... It's got this kind of elaborate setup at the beginning as well. And I think you expect more. Mm. You're watching and you're expecting more from each story, and then it just sort of suddenly drifts off and ends, and there's no real kind of revelation offered.
I also thought the sort of... the beings, we shall call them, the creepy monsters were quite hokey. And there's quite a few, like, close-ups of them, and I was like, this just looks like it was made in someone's garage, which it probably was, but I don't know, it didn't really...
You didn't get scared, Hannah?
I
got really scared for the first half hour. In fact, the scariest part was the opening titles. There's some nasty sound effects.
Oh,
in
God.
Actually,
the opening titles did get me.
Yeah. And then the first part in the old asylum I found very scary, but I'm so easily scared, and we'll come on to that when we get into... Don't look now.
Right.
Later. But anyway, okay, so Hannah, do you want to give it some scores?
I think it's like a 4-3-3. I was quite excited by the premise of it. I like Jeremy Dyson, mm-hmm. Andy Nyman. I think it does have a lot of good things about it. And it's nice to see a film that feels really sort of British and specifically Yorkshire-y, mm-hmm. To coin a new word. But yeah, it just didn't really deliver what I was after.
David?
Yeah, I'd probably say similar. I mean, it's like Jeremy Dyson's involved with League of Gentlemen, and there is that kind of slightly grotesque, satirical grotesqueness to it. But at the same time, I think it's making this plea for, we're a serious horror film about serious things. And it's sort of trapped between those two worlds, but it's neither fish nor fowl.
Yeah.
I like its ambition, but it didn't quite come together. So 4-3-3 for me.
Okay, I go 3-2-3. Probably 3 because the finale, at least I can understand that there was a narrative structure, whereas halfway through I was thinking, well, hang on, you haven't finished that bit off. Where are we going to now? Which was a little bit frustrating. You'll see what I mean if you see the film, which by all means do. Anyway, other options this week include another scary film, Thoroughbreds. Thoroughbreds, David.
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Two upper-class teenage girls in suburban Connecticut rekindle an unlikely friendship after years of growing apart. Together, they hatch a plan to solve both of their problems, no matter what the costs.
Ooh.
That was me talking there, not reading from a script, just
wonderful.
To let you know.
Oh, you sell it really nicely.
Yes.
I'm really keen to see this film. Sadly, I wasn't able to accompany you to the preview. I've seen it billed as Heathers Meets American Psycho. Is that a fair summary?
I don't tend to love those kind of X meets Y adjudications, but yeah, you probably could say that. You could probably say that about anything, really. But
yeah, I mean, I say that about myself a lot.
This podcast is, I would describe as Heather's meets American Psycho.
Right.
Meets with Nell and I. Is all that. But yeah, it's a really impressive film. It's this guy, Corey Finley, who was an ex-journalist and has written for the stage, and he has sort of come out of the traps with this quite nasty little sort of psychodrama where you've got these two very bitchy New England teenage girls who, there is this sort of sense that they're very kind of disconnected from their peers, and you know, they're unsatisfied with their lives as well, and the only kind of pleasure they get is through causing pain to other people, really.
Wow. You compare it in your review to Michael Haneke's Funny Games.
I wouldn't say it's so kind of academic as Funny Games. Funny Games is very much a kind of, you can see the director's hands on everything and he's manipulating you in a very kind of purposeful way. But this is like, I guess I mean that it's nasty in a very kind of unrepentant way.
Immoral, almost.
It is almost immoral, and I think it's celebrating that side of the characters. I think you do maybe see a slither of empathy in what they're doing, but he really kind of conceals it to a level that makes it actually, like, you know, they're hard to empathise with. And I think it maybe makes the film a tougher sell in that you don't necessarily come away from the film thinking like the heroes won the day, or like that you were rooting for these two cool characters, like as you maybe do for Winona Ryder and Heathers. You know, these characters don't really offer themselves up to you as kind of like, they're so cool, I admire what they're doing with their lives, you know.
Olivia Cooke plays Amanda and Anya Taylor-Joy Lily, the central two, with Anton Yelchin, a central part of the film, in what was his final performance?
Yeah, it was kind of bittersweet seeing him, because when I went to see this, I didn't know he was in it, and then he sort of popped up on screen. Sort of strange reaction for me seeing him on the screen, because I remember watching things he was in when I was a teenager, like Charlie Bartlett, which I really liked, and yeah, he's quite good in it. I wouldn't say it's like his best role that he ever did.
Hmm. He does bring that kind of scuzzy stoner charm to a role,
yeah,
which I like.
Have you guys seen the film Green Room?
Oh, I loved Green Room.
He was really, really good in Green Room. And this is a very different vibe from him. He plays this sort of hapless drug dealer that they involve in their plan. But I think it reminded me a lot of Less Than Zero, which is another Bret Easton Ellis book / terrible film starring Robert Downey Jr. And it's very laconic, very, like David said, it's very hard to sympathise with these girls. But I think that's a real credit to Olivia Cooke and Anya Taylor-Joy. They're fantastic in it. And especially after watching Ready Player One, which gave Olivia Cooke so little to do for 2 hours, it was really nice to see something where she's given this real like meaty role to sink her teeth into.
So Less Than Zero meets Heathers meets American Psycho meets
Funny Games.
Funny Games. It's funny?
It's darkly funny. I don't necessarily think there's like jokes in there, but like it's, you know, that
is it gory?
There's a violent undertow to it.
If you like horses, you might want to give it a miss.
Is it scary?
I don't think it's scary.
Okay, well this is all adding up.
It's quite pleasing. It's tense, but I think you kind of get from the beginning where it's going. I did anyway, but maybe that's because I know that teenage girls are psychotic. So you know, but it's definitely worth seeking out.
Okay, and is there anything you didn't like about it?
I think that it may be the thing that maybe prevented it from getting like 5 stars from me is it's not the most original film. It does its thing very well, but it maybe doesn't offer anything. I didn't watch this film and think, wow, I've never seen that before. And another film is The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Right.
That's
so it's got that kind of detached, slightly ironic handling, is it?
Yeah, but now I've just been transported back to watching that film. That scarred me for life.
Did you not like Killing of a Sacred Deer?
No, I absolutely loved it.
Okay. So, numbers, David?
4's across the board for me.
Oh, that's, yeah.
Yeah, 4's across the board.
Really?
We're having a good week. We're agreeing on everything, David and I, so far.
Well, let's see what you make of A Quiet... No, actually, we can't, because you guys didn't see A Quiet Place.
You know, I was going to go and see it on Monday night, and I went and saw Love, Simon instead.
So A Quiet Place, I think, is officially out in the UK this Friday. But
Thursday.
Thursday, is it?
Today.
Yeah, what is today as we record this? But they'd actually done one of those soft releases where it was on all over London, certainly, previously. So I was really intrigued by the premise. You basically plop down in a post-apocalyptic world with a family who are clearly hiding out from some unseen danger and being very careful about not making a noise. And it emerges that the terror that they face that has brought about the kind of downfall of civilization are these alien hunters who hunt by sound. So they have evolved a kind of year or so on into this new reality.
Is that a spoiler?
No.
No, okay.
So they've evolved a kind of soundless way of living. They've poured sand all over the place to muffle their footsteps. They've managed to try and iron out any of the kind of noisy things they might normally do. But a slight complication in this is that the mother of this family, Emily Blunt, is pregnant and about to give birth, which, generally speaking, is one of the more... It's towards the noisy end of the spectrum as regards human activities. So there's that. It's a high-concept film. It's very much a one-act film, this. Watching it, there are elements in it you think, ooh, I wonder where they're going to go with that. And the answer is nowhere. This is the bit you get. This is the little window you get. We're not going through the window looking out either side. You're just going to see this bit. And as such, it's quite a satisfying film because it's only, I think, 70 or 80 minutes long, which is great. It does what it came to do, and then it leaves. I would say that it drops off my score a little bit at the end because there are a couple of gaps in the plot that when you look at them logically, you think, well, hang on, surely, but and how about this and why not that? But in terms of a neat little horror pitched on a certain narrative device, how will you get through life if you can't make a sound? It's very effective.
Were you scared? Because I know you scare easy.
I do scare easy. The answer is no. I was mildly tense, I think.
It sounds to me from your description, it reminds me of that film. Did you ever see the film Pitch Black?
Oh, yeah.
With Vin Diesel.
Yes, I did.
Where they have to kind of
it's get, better than pitch
get through
black.
The pitch black.
But yeah, I see you.
With the aliens who can see
exactly.
In the dark.
So. There's a certain kind of physical condition which you have to get past that. And if you can do that, then you'll be okay. But yeah, I mean, go and see it, listeners, and then we can have a conversation on Twitter about, for me, what was the big question about, well, why did nobody, etc. Yeah. By the way, Brian Woods and Scott Beck's original screenplay only contained one line of dialogue.
Oh, that would have been cool.
That would have been amazing. So I'm going to give it 3-4-3, because at the time I was caught up in it, and it was only afterwards that went, or maybe in the last 5 minutes, that was a little bit hang on there. But yeah, perfectly decent thriller. Now, it features, by the way, Emily Blunt. Her husband, John Krasinski, also directed. Noah Jupe, who plays the son of the family, and Millicent Simmons, who's the daughter who is deaf, as is Millicent Simmons. And she actually appears in another film we're reviewing this week, Wonderstruck. And we'll get onto that after I read out this from the Little White Mailbag, courtesy of Rory. Oh, you're a fan of making comparisons, David. He draws a line between Isle of Dogs and the 1981 classic Escape from New York with a fantastic Kurt Russell on song. So many elements reminded me of Manhattan in 1997. Looking into the future, both were rat-infested dystopic trash islands with society's blemish banished forevermore with the future idea of ultimately a painful death. There's a glider and a mini plane that endure a mild crash landing in both with the protagonist surviving after piloting. You could even go so far, says Rory, as to look at Snake's eye patch in conjunction with Atari's black eye or Chief's broken eye at different points. What do you make of that?
Wow, he's gone deep on that one.
He's Wes Anderson. A lawsuit here.
Legal.
Rory would also like to add the John Carpenter soundtrack Cool Capital Calling card, I think he means Escape from New York, to our film club list. A film of actually of Carpenter's that I want to go back and see is Assault on Precinct 13.
Oh yeah.
Astonishing.
The original one.
That's funny, actually. I went to see Isle of Dogs again this weekend. Oh. And Wes Anderson has said that one of his big inspirations was Akira Kurosawa.
Right.
And the listeners might not know, they might know, but the Kurosawa actually made this kind of career-killing film in the 80s called Dodeskaden. Like, he was making all these amazing samurai films and action films with Toshiro Mifune, and they kind of split up. And then he had a bit of a kind of... He stopped making films for a while.
Mm-hmm. A sabbatical?
Sabbatical, yeah. And then he came back with this weird comedy set on a dump, and it was various eccentric characters going about their days living on this dump in Japan. And it was a massive flop. But it's kind of fascinating to see now, and it's got this kind of quirky sense of humour, and I'm pretty sure Wes Anderson must have given that a squiz before making Island
Interesting.
Dogs.
Interesting. How many times have you seen it so far, Hannah?
I've only seen it once.
Because you were very much 5 out of 5 for this, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. I saw this in Berlin when it came out, and I think it's still like a 5-star movie for me, but I think I'm a bit worn out of all the kind of discourse around it.
Maybe you should go and see it at the Picture House in Clapham, where I think it's one of the many places that they did dog screenings.
Yeah.
You know where they...
Our colleague went to the dog screening.
Yeah.
And he said that apparently... Do you know the bit with Harvey Keitel's dog going, ooh?
Did all the dogs
all
go?
The dogs all the dogs went, ooh.
So, yeah, I heard that when the film started, they were all rapt. They gazed rapt
I'd
at the
like
screens.
To go
and when
to...
the rats came on, they went crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently so.
I'd like to go to a cat screening of it, just to see how they react.
They won't react, they're the cats.
They don't react
They'll
to
just
anything.
Curl a lip at the... yeah, well, that's fascinating. Well done, cinemas. Wonder you could do that as, you know, theme your screening. Finding Nemo would be exceptional. A lot of people with kind of big bowls of water. And, we'll move on. Wonderstruck up next. Wonderstruck, which is the new one from Todd Haynes, which is always an exciting thing. This essentially takes two parallel stories and weaves them together. They ultimately converge. I don't think it's giving too much away, is it?
No.
To say that. One is from 1927, at the dawn of the talkies, and young Rose, played by Millicent Simmons, runs away to New York City in search of the silent screen star Lillian Mayhew. Then in 1977, 50 years on, a young fellow called Ben, who's just become deaf after being struck by lightning.
Yeah, I'm worried about that. Is that a thing that can happen?
I don't know.
Does it go down a telephone line?
It does go down a telephone line.
Yeah, that couldn't happen today.
He gets struck by lightning in his ear.
In his ear. And then he runs away to New York to search for a father that he never knew. It's a curious film. It's, I would say, partly unsuccessful, but it does have some extraordinary moments in it. What did you think, David?
Oh, no, I totally agree with what you're saying there. I mean, it's like... With Todd Haynes, I think you don't really... from the outset, it looks like a kind of magical family kids movie. And I'm sure that people, you know, selling this film may want you to think that. And it's absolutely not that at all. It maybe has elements of a very kind of idiosyncratic and prone-to-weirdness director trying to make that type of movie. I mean, to give a bit of context, actually, it's... Brian Selznick wrote Hugo Cabaret, which is the film that Martin Scorsese made Hugo on. I actually love Hugo, and I think it's probably superior to this film in that it's got a slightly simpler structure. It's this kind of very strange hipster kids movie that has all these incredible moments. The elements of the filmmaking, the costume design, the production design, the music, the way it's all filmed, the way the silent elements are kind of constructed, and the performance by Julianne Moore, for instance, and the two young leads, all the elements are there, and yet it never quite comes together. And yeah, it's wonderful moments in search of a kind of wider purpose, I guess. And like, which is kind of weird in that, you know, it is a film about these two people who are searching for the wider purpose of their lives, and they kind of find it in an obscure way. But yeah, it leaves a little kind of like... There's a sort of so what element to it.
Do you think it would have benefited from a slightly straighter telling?
No, I'm not sure how you could tell this story in a straight way. I mean, it is what it is, I guess.
Right. It's funny because previous films of his, Carol certainly and Far From Heaven, largely because those I think are the only two I've seen, tonally they're quite of a piece. He doesn't make wild shifts between one style and another.
He did I'm Not There, which was pretty...
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, really, really good, but pretty out there, but...
Okay, that, like this, does this shifting from one style of movie to another.
Yeah, right. But that, I think he does it really well. This, I don't think he does it quite as well.
What did you not like, Hannah?
I just didn't really care. It was very flowery and very flourishy and lots of intricate things, but it sort of felt like going to a museum where they haven't really curated it very well. And so there's just things everywhere and you're like, okay, well, where do I start with this? What am I meant to be looking at? And the only things that I really, really liked were the kids in it. I thought they were brilliant.
I love the dioramas. There's some great work with the dioramas.
Yeah.
But it's interesting what you say about the museum thing, because that's clearly a thing that the 70s, for example, in this film was treated very much as a museum. And there's this almost heavy-handed use of 70s music. Every time we cut to the 70s, you must have a big slab of Thus Spake Zarathustra or whatever.
It does have one of my all-time fantasies as a child was to, like, live in a museum. And it has this whole thing where they go and live, like, the kids go and live in a museum.
Which museum would you have lived in?
Well, it would have been like the London Museum of Natural History. Because, like, to me as a kid, that was the best place in the world.
Right. This is basically
the film of that dream.
Yeah, it is. Maybe I just wanted like 2 hours of kids just like getting up to some hijinks in a museum. Maybe I would have preferred that.
There is a Ben Stiller film that you're really going to enjoy.
There's many of them. That's the thing for me. It felt very strange where like this kid who is apparently doing this wondrous thing by sneaking around in the back rooms of a museum and having all these kind of curiosities and cabinets and drawers and things that he can look through, and when he gets to the museum, it's really boring. They don't do anything
there. The kid's kind of a dick as well. Like, wow. So Millicent Simmons' character, Rose, is like really sweet and lovely, but Oakes Fegley, who I really liked in Peach Dragon, by the way, is the young boy who is turned deaf by lightning, and he's just kind of a dick. Like,
is he?
Yeah, to the friend he makes.
Oh yeah, he is.
Yeah, there's other kids helping him out and trying to like help him find his dad, and he's just a dick to him.
Yeah,
like, I wouldn't. You know, I've.
Yeah. Strong words, Hannah. Okay. Well, what numbers would you like to give this?
Oh, I think it's like a 4-3-2, maybe.
Really?
Yeah, just. I expect more from Todd Haynes, you know. After Carol, which I loved so much, this was a major disappointment.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with you on the 4 because the premise of it sounded really interesting as well, this notion of parallel journeys to the same city by people with similar conditions but 50 years apart sounded really, really intriguing. And there's something tonally about it which never draws you in, I guess. But there are some moments of, 3 and maybe a... 3.
I feel the same. I mean, I love Todd Haynes, and I think Carol's incredible. And I think with his best films like Carol and Far From Heaven, there is a slightly kind of literary construct to them, and he's using these kind of modes of filmmaking and genre to sort of maybe step back slightly. And I think with this film, it kind of requires him to be a little bit more earnest and sincere and emotional. I just don't think. He kind of fakes it in quite an obvious way here, and it never gets under your skin. I'd say 4-3-3 because I actually would like to quite see it again. I was more like disappointed that maybe I didn't get the film rather than like that I got it and didn't like it.
Okay, having given this a 3, I want to give an extra half now to A Quiet Place because I realised that was a 3 as well. And of the two...
You'd take this, yeah.
No, I would take A Quiet Place. Yeah.
Sorry, yes, of course.
Yeah. Right, well, let's move on to Film Club then, which this week, excitingly, is Don't Look Now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Girl, and she was laughing. Yes,
my sister's psychic.
She wants you to know. I've seen her. and she wants you to know that she's happy.
Christine.
John, do you hear what I say? It was Christine.
My daughter is dead, Laura. She does not come peeping with messages back from behind the grave.
Yes.
Christine is dead.
Yes.
She is dead.
Yes.
Dead, 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 dead.
Can I come out now? Wow. The very creepy Don't Look Now. 1973, Nicholas Roeg. Adapting Daphne du Maurier's work, she wrote him a letter, apparently. This is fabulous. After seeing the film, congratulating him on making such a strong film from her story. When was the last time you heard of an author congratulating a director on the adaptation?
I was just thinking that's like the opposite of Ken Kesey, yeah, with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. How great to get a letter from her as well.
Really, yeah.
Must have been...
Anyway, voted number one in Time Out's list of the best British films. This was voted on by the film industry, it just says. Not sure who in the film industry.
I actually did that poll.
Did you?
When I was working at Time Out.
No so, way, David.
I was instrumental in helping that.
What was number two? One. Be like Hal Pressburger, Matter of Life and Death, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
With Nell.
All right. Now, a question that I raised when we mentioned last week we were doing this was the sex scene, which I'd always heard. I mean, the great urban legend about this film was that they were actually doing it and the cameras rolled. But I read that this scene was actually the first time that Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie met, and Nicholas Roeg filmed it first to get it out the way so it wouldn't be kind of hanging over them. So which version is true? Were they at it, David Jenkins?
I don't know. It's one of those urban legends that you just want to leave be and only watch it and decide for yourself. The scene itself is so kind of magnificent that you kind of think it's better to have that kind of did they, didn't they conundrum when you finish it.
Listeners, if you didn't catch this, you really should. It's the story of a married couple, played by Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, grieving the recent death of their young daughter, who travelled to Venice so that he can do some restoration work on a church there, which is busy tumbling into the lagoon. It just so happens they go there while there's also a serial killer on the loose. And a series of premonitions starts presaging something really, really dark. Now, when we look at listeners' comments here, Will in Birmingham says, how come A.C. Jimbo didn't tell the whole tale about why he screamed at the end of Don't Look Now? I'm not sure if Will was there at the ICA that day, but basically I screamed just before the scary bit at the end. So everybody in the cinema turned round and looked at me and missed the denouement. Oh, so I blew Don't Look Now for an entire theatre full of people.
Why did you scream, though?
Because is it just blind before... sister goes, let him not go, and puts a hand out like that, and I just freaked. Yeah, but bear in mind, I also stood out of my seat and screamed during Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It was a similar time in my life. I think I was very jumpy. The bit where Large Marge reveals herself, and when they dragged her body from the wreckage, it looked like this cue effect.
Oh, wow.
And I swallowed my tub of popcorn.
Someone called High Contrast said, I love the editing. Roeg is one of the few to pick the baton from Eisenstein. Score is a fave too.
Well, what does that mean?
Also, I mean, the editing is, he does this kind of impressionistic, intuitive editing where he's like, you know, as you watch it, he's connecting images together and colours together. It's not like the story is the thing. It's like, let's just move through this film in a kind of impressionistic way. Let's link red to red and this figure to this figure and this building to this building. And Roeg is kind of known for that, for all of his kind of films like Walkabout, Man Who Fell to Earth, etc., etc.
You get that great Hitchcock reference where he cuts the scream into the sound of the drill in this
as yes.
well.
Yeah. Yes. And the score is by Pino Donaggio. He's sort of really well known for doing these kind of almost sort of like weird, eerie, folky kind of scores with like flutes and instruments you wouldn't expect to hear in horror movies. I mean, his other really famous score is the score for Carrie, which is like this kind of swooning score, but like you're watching the film and it's horrible. And like the same for here, you know, it's this very disarming, quite sort of ethereal score, and it just makes the whole film seem even more terrifying, I think. Joseph Oldham, one of the best ever. I can't think of any other horror film that summons up such a powerfully bleak, cold and sad atmosphere.
Nick McGuffin says one of the great horror films of our time. Now, a couple of people write in saying that they found the ending funny. I laughed out loud at the ending, says Paul Maloney. Can you see how that would happen? I mean, if you're in a cinema with me, maybe.
Maybe people watching it now. I don't think it would have been funny at the time.
No.
I didn't think it was funny. I can see now...
You saw it for the first time for this?
Yeah, I did. But I already knew how it ended because I'd seen Richard Ayoade's Submarine, which has a scene where they kind of riff on the end of Don't Look Now.
Oh, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
That's a great film.
Great film. And he's on the beach looking for his girlfriend and...
I actually get really annoyed when people say they find like classic horror films funny.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real kind of trying to sort of act front and act tough about it. I went to see The Exorcist in 2000 or 1999 when it was re-released.
Mm-hmm.
And I gathered up all my sort of school friends to go and see it at the Prince Charles Cinema. And I was really kind of like shocked by it because this is when it was still very much this kind of monolithic, X-rated, scariest film of all time.
Yeah.
And I remember coming out afterwards and they were all like, oh my God, it was so funny. It looks so terrible. Oh my God, it just... Oh.
And you burned and, with indignation.
I was just like, I think that says a lot about you. I think they're hiding some sort of deep-seated emotions there.
What was it they found so funny? The projectile vomiting?
Oh,
The head going around?
Like they were laughing at a scene that is often considered... to be the sort of most disturbing moment of the film, which you have to engage with the ideas of the mother and daughter.
Is it the crucifix?
It involves a crucifix, yeah. And they were audibly laughing during that. And it was I almost think there could be a horror film about me going back to kill all those people for laughing at this.
I tell you what, listeners, don't touch. That's ours. That's a brilliant premise.
Let's do that.
I know what you saw last summer, that
yes,
kind of thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Jimbo Holdings.
There are some like iconic horror films that people do feel it's okay to kind of just be like, oh, I wasn't scared. Like The Shining is another one that a lot of people are like, oh, I thought it was funny.
But that's a weird one because there's films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Shining, which I think The Shining's meant to be funny. And also
the
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Right.
The end of The Shining's meant to be funny.
I think so.
There are
genuinely
like very scary bits of The Shining.
Oh, no, I agree.
And Texas Chainsaw Massacre, yeah.
I've read things on The Shining where people argue that it's a comedy.
The end kind of fits with that, no?
Looping back to Don't Look Now, I think what it's this kind of study of grief and a couple coming to terms with their child like drowning and dying. And with that context, there's not really anything in the film. I don't think Nick Rowe makes any real funny films. I mean, I can't think of a moment... Like, if you think of the films he's made... Eureka, Bad Timing. There's no funny stuff in Nick Rogue films. When has Nick Rogue ever been funny?
I'm not sure. I've not seen Eureka. That's the Marilyn Monroe.
Insignificance, which is incredible.
And that's not funny?
That's quite funny, but in a sort of weird way, because it is all couched in the apocalypse. So
not so much. What about Eureka? What's that?
Eureka's really, really dark. It's a kind of like his take on a sort of Citizen Kane story with Gene Hackman as an oil prospect. It's very, very much influenced for There Will Be Blood.
Right.
Ooh.
So, but it's really
future
dark.
Future film club, perhaps.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah. One other detail about this, Renato Scarpa, who plays Inspector Longhi, with a particularly chilling performance. Apparently he didn't speak any English, so he just read out the lines he'd been given without knowing what they meant, which adds to the sinister quality of his character. It's a great idea, isn't
amazing.
It? Yeah.
Oh, Hannah? I just wanted to say, because we were kind of talking about this earlier, and it's on here, in fact, the Italian title of this film is brilliant.
Oh, Italian titles of films are so bad, but go on.
No, I'll get you to read it, since you are the expert. It's there.
Ah, okay. A Venezia, un dicembre rosso shocking. So that's
so
in
good.
Venice... Because rosso shocking, it's a kind of red. It's like shock red.
Shocking red.
Yeah, so in Venice, a shock red December in Venice. Yeah, when they translate titles, they often come out a little bit less effective.
Don't Look Now, you'd think...
Yeah.
The German one's even better,
simple.
I have to say. Wenn die Gondeln trauer tragen.
Wow, that does sound scary.
Which means when gondolas wear grief.
Well, yeah, that works. And is that all one word, can I ask?
No.
Okay. That's not like a compound word.
Airplane, for example, which is a pretty simple title, came out in Italian as L'aereo più pazzo del mondo, the craziest airplane in the world.
You see, if I had to go and see Airplane or the craziest airplane in the world, I know where I'm headed.
Ah, good. Where are we headed for Film Club next week?
So we're headed to the Old West via Italy. In we're going to be looking at Sergio Leone's A Fistful of Dollars.
Right.
So catch up on that if you
can. And why is that?
Because one of the films we're going to be covering is this really great movie called Western. It's set in Bulgaria, and it's directed by the German female director Valeska Grusbeck.
Okay.
This film is very much a kind of like impressionistic Western, and this one's a very kind of classical one. It's also getting a kind of re-release as well.
So what,
cinematic one after the podcast. So if you don't happen to catch up on it or have it fresh in your mind, there will be an opportunity to go and see it on the big screen.
Brilliant. Nice one. So that's one film we're doing next week. I do hope we're also going to do Rampage.
I believe so.
All right.
You're both looking at me. I've taken on the mantle as the official Dwayne Johnson expert in our office now.
Uh-huh.
I've decided I'm that expert.
Excellent.
That's great. It's just.
Have you seen Rampage?
No. Hopefully you're going to see it.
Tuesday morning.
But I'm not sure you're qualified because you didn't realise that it was based on 80s, 90s.
It was based on a video game. I was born.
Is it a video game?
Yeah.
About fighting giant monkeys.
No. You are the giant monkeys.
You are the giant monkey.
And you have to race to destroy a city before, like, the soldiers and the little helicopters shoot you down.
Okay, well, in the film,
Dwayne plays against type as not the giant monkey, and he leaps onto a building from a helicopter or something.
In the
leaps
trailer,
from something
he
to somewhere.
Is friends with the monkey.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like Mighty Joe Young.
Oh, nice. Well, we'll find out more next week, hopefully, along with Western and, as you say, A Fistful of Dollars.
Yes.
Do get watching A Fistful of Dollars and let us know your thoughts or on anything else you want to talk about. The address is truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, or you can find us on Twitter @LWLies, or there's the Facebook page and the Little White Lies website. Anything else, Hannah, before we wrap up for this week?
Go and see Thoroughbreds.
Yeah, David?
Yeah, I would say I would co-sign on that. I don't think it's getting the biggest release.
No, it's not. It's not getting a very big release, so see it whilst you can.
But that's this week's winner, then, Thoroughbreds.
I would say so. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Listeners, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.